leader, either as sun or as moon, according to the local cult, and an organization of the walled city in the manner of a mandala about the central sanctum of the palace and the ziggurat, and with a mathematically structured calendar, furthermore, to regulate the seasons of the city's life according to the passages of the sun and moon among the stars, as well as a highly developed system of ritual arts, including an art of rendering audible to human ears the harmony of the visible celestial spheres. It is at this moment that the art of writing first appears in the world, and that literally documented history begins. It is at this moment that the wheel appears, and we have also evidence that the two numerical systems that are still normally employed throughout the civilized world had just been developed, namely the decimal and the sexagesimal. The former used for business accounts in the offices of the temple compounds where the grain was stored and that had been collected in taxes, and the latter used for the ritualistic measuring of space and time. 360 degrees still represent the circumference of the circle, that is to say, the mandala of space, while 360 days plus 5 mark the measurement of the mandala of time, the cycle of the year. And those 5 intercalated days, which represent the opening through which spiritual energy flows into the sphere of time from the Pleroma of Eternity, and which, consequently, are days of feast and festival, correspond in the temporal mandala to that mystical point in the center of the spatial mandala, which is the sanctuary of the temple, where the earthly and heavenly powers join. The 4 sides of the temple tower, oriented to the 4 points of the compass, come together at this 5th point, where the energy of the Pleroma enters time, and so once again we have the number 5 added to 360 to symbolize the mystery of the imminence of eternity in time. This temple tower, of course, and the hieratically organized little city surrounding it, where everyone plays his role according to a celestial-inspired divine plan, is the model of paradise that we find not only in the Hindu-Buddhist imagery of Mount Sumeru, the Greek Olympus, and the Aztec temples of the sun, but also in Dante's earthly paradise, for which Columbus went in search, and in the biblical image of Eden, from which the medieval concept was developed, and which, according to the date that you will find in the marginal notes of your Bible, would have been created just about at the time of the founding of the first Sumerian towns, 4004 BC. It appears, in short, to have been demonstrated in a manner hardly to be doubted that the idea of the hieratic city-state, conceived as a mesocosm or sociological imitation of the celestial order, first emerged as a paradigm in the little cities of Sumer, circa 3200 BC, and was then disseminated westward and eastward, along the ways already blazed by the earlier Neolithic. The wonderful life-organizing assemblage of ideas and principles, including those of writing, mathematics, and calendrical astronomy, reached the Nile and inspired the civilization of the first dynasty of Egypt, circa 2800 BC, reached Crete on one hand and, on the other, the Indus Valley circa 2600 BC, Shang China circa 1500 BC, and finally Peru and Middle America from China by way of the Pacific, possibly as early as circa 1000 BC. We have, therefore, to recognize what now appears to be the demonstrated and documented fact that all of the high civilizations of the world are finally but so many variants and developments of a single marvelous monad of mythological inspiration, and that whereas the history and prehistory of the human race covers some 1,750,000 years, this monad was constellated and brought into a living form in the mudflats and among the reeds of Mesopotamia hardly more than 5,000 years ago. If we should attempt to put into words the sense or meaning of this monad, the sense or character of the realization that appears to have precipitated with such force this image of man's destiny as an organ participating in the organism of the universe, we might say that the psychological requirement already noted for a coordinating principle to bring the parts of a differentiated social body into an orderly relationship to each other and simultaneously to suggest the play through all of a higher, all-suffusing, all-informing principle or energy, this profoundly felt psychological as well as sociological requirement must have been fulfilled with the recognition, sometime in the 4th millennium BC, of the orderly round dance of the 5 visible planets and the sun and moon through the constellations of the zodiac. And this celestial order was to become, for all the civilizations and philosophers of the world, the model of the revelation of destiny. In the words of Plato, the motions akin to the divine part in us are the thoughts and revolutions of the universe. These, therefore, every man should follow, and correcting those circuits in the head that were deranged at birth, by learning to know the harmonies and revolutions of the world, he should bring the intelligent part, according to its pristine nature, into the likeness of that which intelligence discerns, and thereby win the fulfillment of the best in life set by the gods before mankind, both for this present time and for the life to come. The Egyptian term for this order was Ma'at. In India it is Dharma, and in China, Tao. And if we now should attempt to epitomize in a sentence the sense or meaning of all the myths and rituals that have sprung from this conception of a universal order, we might say that they are its structuring agents, functioning to bring the human order into accord with the celestial. Thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven. The myths and rites constellate a mesocosm, a mediating middle cosmos through which the microcosm of the individual is brought into relation to the macrocosm of the universe. And this mesocosm is the entire context of the body social, which is thus a kind of living poem, hymn, or icon of mud and reeds and of flesh and blood and of dreams, fashioned into the art form of the hieratic city-state. Life on earth is to mirror as nearly perfectly as possible in human bodies the almost hidden yet now discovered order of the pageant of the spheres. This pageant is what has shaped the mesocosm, the middle sociological cosmos of the city, and the patterns of this mesocosm are what then have shaped the soul. Art and custom shape the soul, art lived as ritual. Problem of the new symbol emergent. But then the soul, this microcosm made identical in form with a supposed order of the macrocosm, must be an engram, something impressed or engraved, and not congenital. As already noticed, man at birth is not yet fully man, nor does he become man through a merely physical, biological development. The child, as already remarked, grows and develops for a length of years that in most mammals would constitute a lifetime, and during this period is shaped in its growth by the local social order. To repeat the words of Adolf Portman, man is the incomplete creature whose completion is effected by a historically determined tradition, so that each of us is but a part, a fragment or inflection of what he might have been. And we can understand, in the light of this truth, the command of the Zen master addressed to the candidate who would obtain release from the system of engraved ideas that had become for him his soul, "Show me the face that you had before you were born." Or the question of the Hindu guru, "Where are you between two thoughts?" C.G. Jung has pointed out in one of his numerous discussions of modern mandalas that whereas in the traditional but now archaic forms the central figure was a god, now, as he declares, the prisoner or the well-protected dweller in the mandala does not seem to be a god, in much as the symbols used, stars for instance, crosses, globes, and so on, do not mean a god but rather an apparently most important part of the human personality. One might also say that man himself, or at least his innermost soul, was the prisoner of the protected inhabitant of the mandala. It is evident, he then continues, that in the modern mandala, man, the complete man, has replaced the deity. This replacement, he declares again, is a natural and spontaneous occurrence, and it is always essentially unconscious. And once again, a modern mandala is an involuntary confession of a peculiar mental condition. There is no deity in the mandala, and there is also no submission or reconciliation to a deity. The place of the deity seems to be taken by the wholeness of man. One cannot but think of the words of Paracelsus, I under God in his office, God under me in mine. For the great word and theme of the Renaissance, humanitas, appears at last in our day to have broken the celestial enchantment that enthralled mankind for 6,000 years, and to be offering now a new Alpha and Omega, a new image, a new engram for the center of our mandala. However, before committing ourselves abjectly to this image, as formerly to the image of God, let us pause to ask at this precious moment between two engrams, whether it is not possible to penetrate to that void between two thoughts from which the symbols come, and attain thereby to some sort of independence from the qualification of the current century. For we cannot forget the distinction between sign and symbol defined by Dr. Jung. The sign is a reference to something known. The symbol is a figure by which allusion is made to an unknown. It is, then, into the unknown, beyond both the image of God and the image of man, that we must venture to find the ultimate ground of all these guiding and protecting, edifying yet imprisoning names and forms. Let us now, therefore, dig below the geometrically composed floor of the Neolithic walled town and search the mystery of the Paleolithic cave, where man, if we may judge from the observation of Dr. Roheim, was free, untrammeled, truly self-reliant, and grown up. Part 2. The Shaman and the Priest. This challenge can be approached, I have found, through a legend from that part of the United States still called the Indian Country, where it is still possible to visit hunting tribes only recently influenced by the Neolithic maize culture stemming from Mexico and Central America. Contrasting patterns appear in North America according to whether tribes are hunters or planters. The hunters emphasize in their religious life the individual fast for the gaining of visions. The boy of 12 or 13 is left by his father in some lonesome place, with a little fire to keep the beasts away, and there he fasts and prays 4 days or more, until some spiritual visitant comes in a dream, in human or animal form, to speak to him and give him power. His later career will be determined by this vision, for his familiar may confer the power to cure people as a shaman, to attract and slaughter animals, or to become a warrior. And if the benefits gained are not sufficient for the young man's ambition, he may fast again as often as he likes. An old Crow Indian named One Bluebead told of such a fast. When I was a boy, he said, I was poor. I saw war parties come back with leaders in front and having a procession. I used to envy them, and I made up my mind to fast and become like them. When I saw the vision, I got what I had longed for. I killed 8 enemies. If a man has bad luck, he knows that his gift of supernatural power simply is insufficient, while on the other hand, the great shamans and war leaders have acquired power in abundance from their visionary fasts. Perhaps they have chopped off and offered their finger joints. Such offerings were common among the Indians of the plains, on some of whose old hands there remained only fingers and joints enough to enable them to notch an arrow and draw the bow. Whereas among the planting tribes, the Hopi, Zuni, and other Pueblo dwellers, life is organized around the rich and complex ceremonies of their masked gods. These are elaborate rites in which the entire community participates, scheduled according to a religious calendar, and conducted by societies of trained priests. As Dr. Ruth Benedict observed in her Patterns of Culture, no field of activity competes with ritual for foremost place in their attention. Probably most grown men among the Western Pueblos give to it the greater part of their waking life. It requires the memorizing of an amount of word-perfect ritual that our less trained minds find staggering, and the performance of neatly dovetailed ceremonies that are chartered by the calendar and complexly interlock all the different cults and the governing body in endless formal procedure. In such a society, there is little room for individual play. There is a rigid relationship, not only of the individual to his fellows, but also of village life to the calendric cycle. for the planters are intensely aware of their dependency upon the gods of the elements. One short period of too much or too little rain at the critical moment, and a whole year of labor results in famine. For the hunter, hunter's luck is a very different thing. We may sharpen this contrast by comparing the priest and the shaman. The priest is the socially initiated, ceremonially inducted member of a recognized religious organization, where he holds a certain rank and functions as the tenant of an office that was held by others before him, while the shaman is one who, as a consequence of a personal psychological crisis, has gained a certain power of his own. The spiritual visitants who came to him in vision had never been seen before by any other. They were his particular familiars and protectors. The masked gods of the Pueblos, on the other hand, the corn gods and the cloud gods, served by societies of strictly organized and very orderly priests, are the well-known patrons of the entire village, and have been prayed to and represented in the ceremonial dances since time out of mind. The legend that I wish to recall is the origin legend of the Jicarilla Apache tribe of New Mexico. Originally a hunting people, they entered the area of the maize-growing Pueblos in the 14th century AD and assimilated the local Neolithic ceremonial lore. The legend is long, but I shall summarize and bring us quickly to the point. In the beginning, we are told, nothing was here where the world now stands. No earth, nothing but darkness, water, and cyclone. There were no people living. Only the Haktzin existed. It was a lonely place. The Haktzin, the Apache counterparts of the masked gods of the Pueblo villages, are personifications of the powers that support the spectacle of nature. They created first the Earth Mother and Sky Father, then the animals and birds, and finally man and woman. Throughout the first ages it was dark, but presently the Haktzin produced the sun and moon, which then moved from north to south. And so now the legend goes on to say, there were all kinds of shamans among the people, men and women who claimed to have power from all sorts of things. These shamans saw the sun going from north to south and began to talk. One said, I made the sun. Another, no, I did. They commenced quarreling, and the Haktzin ordered them not to talk like that. But they kept making claims and fighting. One said, I think I'll make the sun stop overhead so that there will be no night. But no, I guess I'll let it go. We need some time to rest and sleep. Another said, perhaps I'll get rid of the moon. We really don't require any light at night. But the sun rose the second day, and the birds and animals were happy. The next day it was the same. When noon of the fourth day came, however, and the shamans, in spite of what the Haktzin had told them, continued to talk, there was an eclipse. The sun went right up through a hole covered overhead, and the moon followed, and that is why we have eclipses today. One of the Haktzin said, All right, you people, you say you have power. Now bring back the sun. So they all lined up. In one line were the shamans, and in another all the birds and animals. The shamans commenced to perform. They showed everything they knew. Some would sit singing and then disappear into the earth, leaving only their eyes sticking out, then return. But this did not bring back the sun. It was only to show that they had power. Some swallowed arrows, which came out of their flesh at their stomachs. Some swallowed feathers. Some swallowed whole spruce trees and spat them up again. But they were still without the sun and the moon. The Haktzin said, All you people are doing pretty well, but I don't think you are bringing back the sun. Your time is up. He turned to the birds and animals. All right, he said. Now it's your turn. They all began to speak to each other politely, as though they were brothers-in-law. But the Haktzin said, You must do something more than speak to each other in that polite way. Get up and do something with your power and make the sun come back. The grasshopper was the first to try. He stretched out his hand to the four directions, and when he brought it back, he was holding bread. The deer stretched out his hand to the four directions, and when he brought it back, he was holding yucca fruit. The bear produced choke cherries in the same way, and the groundhog berries, the chipmunk strawberries, the turkey maize, and so it went with all. But though the Haktzin were pleased with these gifts, the people were still without the sun and moon. Thereupon the Haktzin themselves began to do something. they sent for thunder of four colors from the four directions, and these thunders brought clouds of four colors from which rain fell. Then sending for the rainbow to make it beautiful while the seeds were planted that the people had produced, the Hacktsin made a sand painting with four little colored mounds in a row, into which they put the seeds. The birds and animals sang, and presently the little mounds began to grow, the seeds began to sprout, and the four mounds of colored earth merged and became one mountain which continued to rise. The Hacktsin then selected 12 shamans who had been particularly spectacular in their magical performances, and painting 6 of them blue all over to represent the summer season, and 6 white to represent the winter, called them Tsanati. And that was the origin of the Tsanati Dance Society of the Jicarilla Apache. After that, the Hacktsin made 6 clowns, painting them white with 4 black horizontal bands, one across the face, one across the chest, one across the upper leg, and one across the lower. The Tsanati and the clowns then joined the people in their dance to make the mountain grow. Do you see what has happened to the shamans? They have been discredited in their individualistic Paleolithic style of magical practice and given a place in the social mandala of a seed-planting, food-growing community, as one contributing unit in a larger whole. The episode represents the victory of the principle of a socially anointed priesthood over the highly dangerous and unpredictable force of individual endowment. And the teller of the Jicarilla Apache story himself explained the necessity for incorporating the shamans in the ceremonial system. These people, he said, had ceremonies of their own which they derived from various sources, from animals, from fire, from the turkey, from frogs, and from other things. They could not be left out. They had power, and they had to help too. I do not know of any myth that represents more clearly than this the crisis that must have faced the societies of the Old World when the Neolithic order began to make its power felt in a gradual conquest of the most habitable portions of the earth. The situation in New Mexico and Arizona at the period of the discovery of America was, culturally, much like that which must have prevailed in the Near and Middle East and in Europe from the 4th to 2nd millenniums B.C., when the rigid patterns proper to an orderly settlement were being imposed on peoples used to the freedom and vicissitudes of the hunt. And there is an important parallel to be noted between this contrast of the wild, quarrelsome, dangerous shamans and the people who were so polite to each other that they were like brothers-in-law, and that of the titans and gods, devils and angels, asuras and devas in the numerous agriculturally based traditions of Asia and Europe. In the Hindu Puranas, there is a well-known myth of the gods and demons cooperating under the supervision of the 2 supreme deities, Vishnu and Shiva, to churn the milky ocean for its butter. They took the world mountain as a churning stick and the world serpent as a twirling rope, and wrapped the serpent around the mountain. Then the gods, taking hold of the head of the snake and the demons the tail, while Vishnu supported the world mountain, they churned for 1,000 years and produced in the end the butter of immortality. It is almost impossible not to think of this myth when reading of the efforts of the quarrelsome shamans and orderly people under the supervision of the Apache Hacktsin to make the world mountain grow and carry them to the world of light. The Tsanati and clowns, we are told, joined the people in their dance, and the mountain grew until its top nearly reached the hole through which the sun and moon had disappeared. And it remained then only to construct 4 ladders of light of the 4 colors up which the people could ascend to the surface of this our present earth. The 6 clowns went ahead with magical whips to chase disease away, and were followed by the Hacktsin, and then the Tsanati came, after whom the people and animals. And when they came up onto this earth, said the teller of the story, it was just like a child being born from its mother. The place of emergence is the womb of the earth. The Wild Gander. The highest concern of all the mythologies, ceremonials, ethical systems, and social organizations of the agriculturally based societies has ever been that of suppressing the manifestations of individualism, and this has been generally achieved by compelling or persuading people to identify themselves not with their own interests, intuitions, or modes of experience, but with archetypes of behavior and systems of sentiment developed and maintained in the public domain. For example, in India, the ideal of Dharma is that of an unconditional submission to the archetypes of caste, these being functions of the social order rationalized for the individual by way of a theory of graded incarnations through many lifetimes from caste to caste. The sternest expression of this ideal is simplified in the word sati, sati, which is the feminine form of the verbal root sat, to be. A sati is a woman who is something, namely an archetypal wife. She has suppressed every impulse to become an autonomous individual, even to that final extent of throwing herself on her husband's funeral pyre. For in the archaic Orient, every act well performed is an act of sati, a burning out, purging out of ego. In the Occident, too, ego has been regarded as the province of the devil. The Titans conquered by the Olympians were incarnations of this principle, just as the demons were in India. And we know how they were chained and imprisoned beneath mountains. A similar fare was accorded in the Germanic tradition to the giants and dwarves, the Fenris wolf, the Midgard serpent, and the dog Garm. However, the day will come, we are warned, when their chains will drop away, and that day will be the weird of the gods, Ragnarok. Then shall nothing be without fear in heaven or on earth. But that day has already come, indeed has been here since 1492, when the mandala broke that had been fashioned 6,000 years before, in the period of the Halaf and Samara bulls. Aeschylus, in Prometheus Bound, represented the spirit of the Titan who is now loose. In one round sentence, every god I hate, that injures me who never injured him, deem not that I, to win a smile from Jove, will spread a maiden's smoothness o'er my soul, and importune the foe whom most I hate, with womanish upliftings of the hands. It is not by accident that Prometheus became the hero of the humanistic Enlightenment, or that today, when the mythos of the mandala is in full disillusion, we find a symbol of the wholeness of man emerging from the dark abyss of the unconscious where it has been chained for 6,000 years. Will the mandala continue to contain this unbound Prometheus? There have been collected from the American tribes hundreds of popular tales depicting in various transformations the Firebringer, the titanic trickster hero of the Paleolithic hunters. Among the Plains Indians, his form was that of a kind of jackal, coyote. Among the forest dwellers, he was the Great Hare, some of whose adventures have been attributed by the Negroes of America to an African rabbit hero whom we meet in the tales of Br'er Rabbit. Among the tribes of the Northwest Coast, he was the raven. The closest counterpart in the myths of Europe would be the mischief-maker, Loki, who at the time of Ragnarok will be the leader of the hosts of hell. Coyote, raven, the master hare, or old man, as he is called when he appears in a fully human form, is a lecherous fool as well as an extremely clever and cruel deceiver. But he is also the creator of mankind and shaper of the world. It is hardly proper to call such figure a god or even to think of him as supernatural. He is a super shaman, and we find his counterparts in myth and legend throughout the world, wherever shamanism has left its mark, in Oceania and Africa, as well as in Siberia and Europe. Authorities differ as to the period of the first migrations of Paleolithic man into North America. During the glacial ages, a land bridge as wide as the nation of France stretched from Siberia to Alaska, and across this grazing animals passed, herds of horses, cattle, elephants, camels, sometimes followed by hunters. As already noted, tribes of men may have begun arriving as early as 30 or 40,000 BC. However, the majority, if not all, of our present American Indian races represent much later periods of migration, extending even into the first millennium AD, and these were not purely Paleolithic. They appear to have stemmed largely from a late Paleo-Mesolithic culture platform in Siberia, in the neighborhood of Lake Baikal, where the Yakuts and the Tungus, the Vogels and the Ostiak live today. In fact, it has been recognized that in physical race, the Vogel and the Ostiak of the Yenisei River Basin might be classified as Americanoid. I have already spoken briefly of the Paleolithic caves. Early in the history of the art of these imposing underground temples, there appeared the famous Paleolithic female statuettes, a full 20,000 years or so before their Neolithic counterparts, in a date range at the close of the glacial era, not much earlier, if at all, than that of the first arrivals of hunters in the New World. No Paleolithic statuettes have been found in Spain or anywhere southward of the Pyrenees. All belong to the hunting plains that commenced north of the Pyrenees and stretched eastward, as far as to the borders of China, and in the neighborhood of Lake Baikal at a site known as Malta, some 85 kilometers northwest of Irkutsk, there was a particularly important Paleolithic hunting station where no less than 20 of these statuettes have been found, associated with a number of figures of flying geese, all carved in mammoth ivory, or, according to one authority, in bone. Thus it appears that in the last great period of the Paleolithic hunt, there was a cultural continuum extending from the Pyrenees to Lake Baikal, whence much of the culture, as well as some of the racial strains, of the hunting tribes of North America were derived during the millenniums following the close of the Paleolithic. A significant continuity, that is to say, appears to have been established, extending in time and space from the Upper Paleolithic of Europe to the final twilight of the Great Hunt in the North American plains. In its various provinces, this tradition absorbed influences both from the local landscape and from neighboring Neolithic and post-Neolithic cultures. Nevertheless, there is a persistent syndrome of motifs that can be readily identified throughout, which is clearly that of a hunting and not of a settled planting system of societies. And one of its most persistent features is the association of the shamanistic trance with the flight of a bird. The hawk and eagle, wild gander and duck appear to be common throughout the range, but locally other birds may appear. The owl and vulture, for example, the raven, magpie, or woodpecker, the last named because of the flash of red on its head, being frequently the chief hero of the fire theft. As Professor Mircea Eliade has shown in an exhaustive study of the subject, the main talent of the shaman is that of throwing himself into a trance at will. The rhythms of the shaman's drum, like the rhythms of the Indo-Aryan Vedic hymns, are conceived as wings, the wings of spiritual transport. They simultaneously elevate the shaman's spirit and conjure his familiars, and it is while in this trance that he performs his miraculous deeds. While in this trance he is flying as a bird to the upper world or descending as a reindeer, bull, or bear to the world beneath. Among the Buryat, the animal or bird that protects the shaman is called Kubilgan, meaning metamorphosis, from the verb kubilku, to change oneself, to take another form. The early Russian missionaries and voyagers in Siberia in the first part of the 18th century noted that the shamans spoke to their spirits in a strange, squeaky voice. They also found among the tribes numerous images of geese with extended wings, sometimes of brass. And here we are reminded that in Malta, that Paleolithic hunting station where no less than 20 female figurines have been discovered, a number of flying geese or ducks were also found, carved like the figurines in mammoth ivory. Flying birds, in fact, have been found in many Paleolithic stations, and on the underwings of one example, as I have already remarked, there appears the earliest swastika of which we have record. Like the swastikas on the much later Samara ware of the High Neolithic, this one is in the sinister form, whirling to the left, the form that Dr. Jung has suggested would normally symbolize a regressive process, such a process perhaps as the shaman flight. And we must remember also that in the Paleolithic cavern of Lascaux, there is a shaman depicted lying in trance wearing a bird mask and with the feather of a bird perched on a staff beside him. The shamans of Siberia wear such bird costumes to this day, and many are believed to have been conceived by their mothers from the descent of a bird. In many lands, the soul has been pictured as a bird, and birds commonly appear as spiritual messengers. Angels are modified birds. But the bird of the shaman is one of particular character and power, endowing him with an ability to fly in trance beyond all bounds of life and yet return. Up above, there is a certain tree, said a shaman of the Tungus, who was questioned at his home on the lower Tunguska River in the spring of 1925. There the souls of the shamans are reared before they attain their powers. On the boughs of this tree are nests in which the souls of the shamans lie and are attended. The name of the tree is Tuuru. The higher the nest is placed in this tree, the stronger will the shaman be who is raised in it, the more will he know, and the farther will he see. The shaman then is not only a familiar denizen, but even the favored scion of those realms of power that are invisible to our normal waking consciousness, which all may visit briefly in vision, but through which he roams, a master. We have observed that the birds found at Malta and in the other Paleolithic stations are ducks and water birds, wild geese and ganders. And I have tried to suggest something also of the rich context of associations linking the figure of the bird to the spiritual flight of the shaman, as well as that linking the figure of the trickster hero, the titan firebringer and demonic enemy of the gods, to the Paleolithic context of shamanism. Let me now add that the Hindu master yogis who, in their trance states, go beyond all the pales of thought are known as Hamsas and Paramahamsas, wild ganders and supreme wild ganders. In the imagery of traditional Hinduism, the wild gander is symbolic of Brahman Atman, the ultimate, transcendent, yet immanent ground of all being, with which the yogi succeeds in identifying his consciousness, thus passing from the sphere of waking consciousness, where A is not not A, passing even beyond dream, where all things shine of their own light, to the non-conditioned, non-dual state between two thoughts, where the subject-object polarity is completely transcended, and the distinction even between life and death dissolved. But before pursuing this developing flight, we must pause for a moment to regard again our problem of the nature and function of the symbol. Mythologies of engagement and disengagement. Two contrasting functions of the religious symbol can now be distinguished. The first is of reference and engagement, the second, disengagement, transport, and metamorphosis. The first is illustrated by the social mandala of the hieratic city-state, which engages every member in a context of experienced significance, relating him as a part to a whole. An equivalent illustration would be the medieval mandala of the church militant, suffering and triumphant. The significance or ultimate ground of such a symbol is unquestioned. Like a successful work of art, it is an end in itself, communicating to the mind beholding it a sense of felicity and to the life engaged in it a sense of meaning. As Dr. Jung has said, the symbol, in contrast to the sign, is the best possible designation or formula for something relatively unknown, yet recognized to be present or required. When, then, the symbol is functioning for engagement, the cognitive faculties are held fascinated by and bound to the symbol itself, and are thus simultaneously informed by and protected from the unknown. But when the symbol is functioning for disengagement, transport, and metamorphosis, it becomes a catapult to be left behind. There is an illuminating representation of the symbol functioning in this manner in the Mundaka Upanishad. The syllable Aum is the bow. The arrow is the soul. Brahman is said to be the target. Undistractedly meditating on Aum, one is to hit the mark. One is to become joined to the target, like an arrow. The rhythm of the shaman's drum is the syllable Aum. His trance is the bird flight of the feathered arrow. His mind, disengaged from the protection of the symbol, is to meet directly the mysterium tremendum of the unknown. But the unknown is of two degrees. There are one, the relatively unknown, and two, the absolutely unknowable. The relatively unknown may be said to be represented psychologically by the contents of the unconscious, sociologically by the dynamics of history, and cosmologically by the forces of the universe. This is the unknown to which reference is made by the term paroksha, discussed earlier, meaning beyond or higher than the reach of the eye. The references of paroksha vocabulary are not immediately perceptible to waking consciousness. They have been said to be adidevata, angelic or divine. They are perceived by saints and sages in vision, and so are said to pertain to the field of dreaming. But in the modern world, we have come to talk and think about such things in a very different way from the sages of the past. Aquinas was correct when he maintained that the scriptures should be found true on both the corporeal and the spiritual levels. At the time of their formulation, they were thought to be corporeally true, and their spiritual truth inhered in the corporeal world of their depiction. Today, that corporeal world has vanished, and another has taken its place. Correlatively, that spiritual world has vanished, and another has taken, or is taking, its place. But no living system of symbols functioning for engagement can survive when it has lost contact with the actual conscious and unconscious worlds of its society, when its references to the field of waking consciousness have been refuted and its notices to the seats of motivation are no longer felt. Like the signs referring to the known, so the symbols referring to the relatively unknown are functions of the knowledge of the time. But there is another degree or category of the unknown, which is that understood to lie beyond even the highest references of a paroksha, mystical, esoteric, spiritual, or angelic vocabulary. "The Tao that can be named is not the true Tao," wrote Lao Tzu at the opening of his Tao Te Ching. "For then alone," wrote Aquinas, "then alone do we know God truly, when we believe that he is far above all that man can possibly think of God." And we have heard the words of the Kenupanishad: "It is other indeed than the known, and moreover, above the unknown." This is the category or degree of the unknown to which all of the high mythologies and high religions are ultimately directed. It is recognized, however, to be absolutely ineffable, a plenum of unknowability, inexhaustible in its dark, and toward it two attitudes have been fostered. The first is that of absolute terror, submission, or, as we say, piety. One does not seek to penetrate, for that would be hubris. One remains with its symbol as the only possible medium of relationship. This is the case of the church suffering, militant, and triumphant, but the second attitude is that of the mystic whose soul would become an arrow, and in this case, the symbol functions only for disengagement. The Sanskrit term is moksha, release, and whereas the symbol functioning for engagement had to remain convincing on the levels of both corporeal and spiritual reference, that function for disengagement need refer to neither. Its function is simply to propel the soul. "Before the moment when I commenced to shamanize," said the old shaman of the Tungus, whom I have already quoted, "I lay sick for an entire year. I became a shaman at the age of 15. The sickness that forced me to become a shaman showed itself in a swelling of my body and frequent fainting spells. When I began to sing, the sickness usually disappeared." And then he told of the visions that he experienced in his period of sickness. "My ancestors appeared to me and began to shamanize. They stood me up like a block of wood and shot at me with their bows until I lost consciousness. They cut up my flesh, they separated my bones and counted them, and they ate my flesh raw. When they counted my bones, they found that there was one too many. Had there not been enough, I should not have been able to become a shaman. While they were accomplishing this rite, I, for a whole summer, ate and drank nothing. At the end, the shaman priests drank the blood of a reindeer and gave some to me also to drink. After these events, a shaman has less blood and looks pale." The same thing happens to every Tungus shaman, the old man went on to say, "only when his shaman ancestors have cut up his body in this manner and separated his bones can he begin to practice." The Tungus shaman's bow did not have the power of that of the Mundakupanishad by any means, for it sent the arrow of his soul only as far as to the sphere of his ancestors in the unconscious, the relatively unknown. Worthy of note in this fantasy, however, is the Paleolithic trait of not assigning any universal cosmic significance to the individual vision. The spiritual powers encountered were the shaman's ancestors merely, and the reference was to himself. But as we have seen in the Jicarilla Apache myth, this strongly individual orientation became archaic and disruptive, titanic and demonic, once the Neolithic organization of the universe around one power center had been effected. We must now therefore attempt to develop our view of the symbol functioning for disengagement under the ban of this constraint, that is to say, within the pale of the mandala itself. And I propose to do this through a brief, necessarily schematic, sketch of the evolution of the ideals and attitudes toward society of the Asian yogi. The flight between two thoughts. This is not an arbitrary choice of illustration, but justified by a number of considerations. The first and most important, I should say, is that in the Orient there is a richly documented history of spiritual disengagement, dating from the period of the earliest Indian Upanishads, which is to say since the 8th century BC. The second is that throughout that long history, the linkage of the techniques and experiences of yoga to their base in the shamanistic trance tradition remained so firm that when Buddhism went northward into Tibet and Mongolia, it readily fused with the local Bon religions in which shamanistic magic played a central role. In fact, the word shaman itself, which is from the language of the Siberian Tungus, has been thought by some to be derived from the Sanskrit shamana, meaning monk, yogi, or ascetic. The legendary biography of the 11th century Tibetan sage Milarepa supplies evidence enough of the close connection. While to this day in certain Buddhist sects of Japan, shamanistic magic is still practiced as a department of religion. Let us not forget, furthermore, that engraved on the chest of the meditating Buddha in the Far East, the counterclockwise swastika frequently appears, which, as we have discussed earlier, made its first appearance on the wings of a Paleolithic flying bird. And then, finally, my third reason for choosing this context to illustrate the reaction of the Titan spirit to the restrictions and archetypes of the hieratic state is that in Asia, these restrictions were never relaxed. The force of the ideals of the archaic caste system, for example, remains tremendous in India to the very present, and so here we still have before us in full force an unrelenting continuation of the vehement dialogue that has been carried on for millenniums between priestly guardians of the social archetypology and the fearless masters of moksha, release. During the course of this grandiose dialogue, four distinct stages can be noted in the transformation of the character of the shamanistic titan. The first, as we have already seen, was that of the shaman as titan demon, overthrower of the gods. The great Indian asuras are figures of this sort. They engage in austerities in the forest, but their aim is not to achieve illumination. It is to gain magical powers and then to apply these to the attainment of their own earthly ends. They are depicted in the mythological tales of India as subjecting themselves to the most rigorous ordeals possible, and through these compelling even the highest gods to submit to their will. But the highest gods, fortunately for the cosmic order, always have a trick or two in reserve, so that in the end the titans are deceived and overthrown. It is clear that we have here, in a mythological rendition, essentially the same notion of the relationship of the individual will to the controls of the social and cosmic order that we find in the Greek tradition, where it is usually presented, however, in human terms. The idea of hubris, individual imprudence, and the necessity that fate or destiny imposes even on the gods runs through the philosophical as well as religious thinking of all high civilizations. There is a moral law, and it must be obeyed. In the Far East, the idea is represented by the Tao, the way, the manifest course, sense, or meaning of the universe. That manifestation of inexorable laws through which all are bound together as the variously functioning organs of a single mighty organism. In India, this binding principle is Dharma. The word is derived from the root dhri, meaning to support, For Dharma, the law, is the support of the universe, and one who knows and performs without resistance his own Dharma, Svadharma, the duties imposed on him by the circumstances of his birth, becomes himself a support, a well-functioning organ of the universal being. The biblical legend of the fall, too, is a tale of hubris and the fall of the Titan, man who dared to follow his own will in contravention of the law imposed in this case not by the universe, but by the maker of the universe, God the Father. Man is here a child, a naughty child, locked out of doors by a stormy parent to freeze and blister. And we know that even as late as the period of the Renaissance, when Europe, having arrived at its age of adolescence and being ready to consign this nursery tale to the past, took to its heart the term humanitas and dared the high adventure of leaving father behind. We know that in this great and bold age, even such a stirring titan as Michelangelo quailed before the realization of what he was doing. Faced in the end with the reckoning of the Last Judgment, the final reckoning of good and evil for eternity, as he called it, now he wrote, "Now know I well how that fond fantasy which made my soul the worshipper and thrall of earthly art is vain." And we know well, too, how those wild titans of Shakespeare's mighty visions shattered one and all on the rocks that ring the world. The formula has been accepted throughout the civilized sphere of the agriculturally based Neolithic mandala psyche, ringed around by the cosmic serpent who both tempts man to dare and crucifies him when he has done so. In this phase of his history, the titan is completely prisoner of the mandala. Its symbols operate upon him in their own terms, both within and without. Still, having a meaning for him, they press upon him from all sides until he breaks. The second stage or phase in the transformation of the Titan is one in which he dissipates and destroys this force for himself, but for no one else. This is the victory represented in India by the forest philosophers, who rejected and despised not only the pains and pleasures of earth, but equally those of hell and heaven. The first requisite of yoga, we read in one statement after another, is the renunciation of the fruits of action, whether in this world or in the next. And in the classical work on the subject, the Yoga Sutra of Patanjali, we read that when the yogi has begun to make progress in the course of his world-renouncing, world-transcending austerities, those in high places, namely the gods, will seek to tempt him from his purpose by seducing him with the joys of heaven. "Sir," they will say, "will you not stay here? Will you not take rest here?" Thus addressed, warns the commentator, "Let the yogi ponder upon the defects of pleasure. Broiled on the horrible coals of the round of rebirths and writhing in the darkness of birth and death, I have only this minute found the lamp of yoga, which makes an end of the obscurations, of the impairments, klesha. The lust-born gusts of sensual things are the enemies of this lamp. How then should it be that I, who have seen its light, should be led astray by these phenomena of sense, this mere mirage, and make fuel of myself for that same old fire again of the round of rebirths, as it flares anew? Fare ye well, O ye sensual things, deceitful as dreams, to be desired only by the vile." Determined thus in purpose, the commentary continues, "Let the yogi cultivate concentration. Giving up all attachments, let him not take pride even in thinking that it is he who is being thus urgently desired even by the gods. For those not yet ready for the high adventure, the gods surround the world and are its guardians. By those ripe, however, the same gods are experienced in dream and vision as mere names and forms, namarupam, no more real, no less real, than the names and forms known to waking consciousness. But in deep sleep, both worlds, that of waking consciousness and that of dream and vision, are dissolved. Would it not be possible, then, to enter the sphere of deep sleep without losing consciousness, and there to see the worlds dissolve, gods and dreams and all? That is the victory of yoga. And one cannot gaze on the world after that with any of the fears and pieties of the virtuous citizen of the mandala, who has not yet watched God himself, together with his universe, evaporate like dew at dawn. As we read in a celebrated Buddhist text, stars, darkness, a lamp, a phantom, dew, a bubble, a dream, a flash of lightning, or a cloud. Thus should one look upon the world. Here is disengagement with a vengeance. The entire mandala of the meso-micro-macrocosm is dissolved, and the individual, having burned out of himself the so-called impairments, klesha, or as we might say, the engrams of his culturally and biologically conditioned personal character, now experiences, through complete withdrawal, the wholeness of an absolutely uncommitted consciousness in the pristine state called kaivalyam, isolation. The universe has been rejected as a meaningless delusion, referring to nothing beyond the mirage of its own horizon, and that transcendent state has been realized which Schopenhauer celebrated at the close of his magnum opus when he wrote that, to those in whom the will has turned and denied itself, this our world, which is so real, with all its suns and Milky Ways, is nothing. According to the Mandukya-Upanishad, the world of the state of waking consciousness is to be identified with the letter A of the syllable Aum, that of dream consciousness, heaven and hell, that is to say, with the letter U, and deep sleep, the state of the mystical union of the knower and the known, God and his world, brooding the seeds and energies of creation, which is the state symbolized in the center of the mandala, with M. The soul is to be propelled both by and from this syllable, Aum, into the silence beyond and all around it. The silence out of which it rises and back into which it goes when pronounced, slowly and rhythmically pronounced as Aum, Aum. Aum. That silence is where we are between two thoughts. The world, the entire universe, its God and all, has become a symbol, signifying nothing, a symbol without meaning. For to attribute meaning to any part of it would be to relax its force as a bow, and the arrow of the soul would then lodge only in the sphere of meaning, like the shaman's soul among his ancestors, or the Christian's among the saints and angels. The bow, in order to function as a bow and not as a snare, must have no meaning whatsoever in itself, or in any part of itself, beyond that of being an agent for disengagement from itself. No more meaning than the impact of the doctor's little hammer when it hits your knee to make it jerk. A symbol, and here I want to propose a definition, is an energy-evoking and directing agent. When given a meaning, either corporeal or spiritual, it serves for the engagement of the energy to itself, and this may be compared to the notching of the arrow to the bowstring and drawing of the bow. When, however, all meaning is withdrawn, the symbol serves for disengagement, and the energy is dismissed, to its own end, which cannot be defined in terms of the parts of the bow. There is no heaven, no hell, not even release, we read in one of the texts celebrating the yogic rapture. In short, this text continues, in the yogic vision, there is nothing at all. It is impossible to say when this absolute dismissal of all that the universe, God or man, might offer began first to enchant the Indian mind, but as early as the period of the Indus Valley civilization between 2500 and 1500 BC, we find the figure of a three-faced divine being sitting in yoga posture, surrounded by animals, and it has been suggested that this must have been an early form of Shiva in the role of Pashupati, the lord of animals, who is the archetype of the forest-dwelling yogi, smeared with ashes to indicate his death to the world and wearing living serpents for bracelets to indicate his transcendence of the world-enveloping serpent. Whereas others are bound by it, he wears it simply as an ornament, or casts it off at will. The idea appears to have come to India, therefore, almost as soon as the mandala itself, and in its earliest phases would appear to have been of such an absolutely ruthless character that the aim of the yogi was no less than physical death. which was to supervene at precisely that moment when the complete extinction within the heart of all fear and hope whatsoever had been accomplished. At that instant of the absolute stilling of the mind, the Titan, perfectly balanced in the stance known as that of dismissing the body, dismissed the body, and with it the whole mandala, with all its priestly kings and kingly priests, heavens and hells, virtues and vices, devils and gods. Something of this ideology can be felt in the Stoic philosophers of the classical world, and in the Near East in the various Gnostic and apocalyptic movements of the time of Christ. In fact, there is too much of the spirit of this same world disdain in the words and deeds of Christ himself to allow us to think